Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are often told that the most important facet of that war at the moment involves Russia. There are those who believe that Russia is not only the great enemy of our time, but that it is very much engaged in efforts to influence and indeed subvert our elections, and the dangers that we may face from other quarters are said to be less consequential than this one. A man who has studied closely, understands deeply, and has helped teach the rest of us a lot over a long period of time about Russia, indeed about the Soviet Union before Russia, is our guest, I'm very pleased to say, for this full hour. He is Dr. Stephen Blank. He is a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council and has been a professor for many years at the U.S. Army War College and a very active contributor to public policy debate and the academic study of Russia, notably over 1,000 articles concerning Soviet Union and Russia and related topics. He has published or edited some 15 books, including ones about Russia's energy program, its relationship with China, the nature of its relationship with its neighbors in the Asian continent, and more. It's always a delight to have him with us. Steve Blank, thank you so much for taking some time to visit with us at length. It's so welcome. Let me start, if I may, by just asking the question that I suppose is most on people's minds, hearing about the efforts of the Russians to influence the 2016 election and now the 2020 election. We're told by a senior Central Intelligence Agency official who testified recently before the House Intelligence Committee that the Russians are once again all in for Donald Trump. Would you just give us a sanity check on what we actually know about all of this and whether that's accurate?
Okay. First of all, it's incontrovertible that they intervened in 2016, mainly on behalf of Donald Trump, because they regarded Trump as more likely to be favorable to their interests than they did Hillary Clinton. And this is a fact. I mean, I know a lot of people want to distort this, but this is the way it actually played out. And they intervened again in 2018 in the congressional elections. So this is a constant thing. It's not just presidential elections. It goes on every day. Right now, as we're sitting here speaking to each other, and they are apparently doing it again in order to support Trump against what Biden, who would probably be, from their point of view, more anti-Russian than Trump, despite what this administration has done. And there's no denying what the administration has done. And within the Democratic primary process, they apparently were supporting Sanders, again, because, one, Sanders is less likely to be as tough on the Russians as Biden's potential Biden government would be. And second, because a Sanders-Trump election, if it came down to that, would be the most polarizing possibility out there. And their fundamental interest is not Donald Trump or you or me or anybody else, but in polarizing and weakening America. So their support for Trump is based on the belief that he will not strengthen America's policy against them the way a different candidate from the mainstream of the Democratic Party, or if some other Republican somehow emerged out of the pack. And that's what's going on right now.
Let me explore this with you, if I may. I want to come back. We'll come back to the tactics in a minute, but just the general proposition here, Steve, seems to me to be so counterintuitive and maybe even counterfactual as to be incredible. I mean, when you look at the candidacy of Hillary Clinton, with whom the Russians had done a lot of business over the years, including, of course, Uranium One and Skolkovo, the building of a Russian Silicon Valley with a lot of American technology, some of it very militarily relevant, by the way. To say nothing of what we've seen Donald Trump do in office, it does seem to me hard to credit the idea that the Russians would actually favor a Trump candidacy in either 2016 or 2020. And I don't disagree that their ultimate objective is to screw us up as much as they can to foster, you know, divisions and to otherwise weaken us. But doesn't it strike you as odd that those who have been notably soft on the Russians over the years, namely Hillary Clinton and I think Joe Biden, would not be actually favored by them?
Well, a couple of things here. First of all, your premise is wrong. Biden and Clinton were not soft on the Russians. And you have to look at these things through Moscow's eyes. And this is the first rule of our business, studying Russia, is to try to understand how they see it, not how you see it. From Putin's point of view, Clinton was the worst possible alternative in 2016. Clinton, as Secretary of State, had denounced the formation of the Eurasian Economic Union as a recrudescence of Soviet Union, and she had attacked Putin for returning to the presidency in 2012 as an out-and-out power grab, and he, undoubtedly with the support of his intelligence agencies, believed that she and the U.S. government were behind the demonstrations in 11-12 against that, and that therefore she must be stopped at all costs. And that's how they saw it. So don't look at it from an American point of view, look at it from a Russian point of view. And that's why the stopping Clinton and now stopping Biden are the paramount objectives of this regime.
Well, we're going to agree to disagree on this. Let's just turn to what you were talking about, or starting to talk about a moment ago. How does Russia do this? What we've been told about the 2016 election was that they invested $100,000 or so in bots that were supposed to influence the election. That didn't seem to be terribly meaningful. Was there more going on, Steve Blank, than that? And is there more now?
Yeah. Okay. There are a series of agencies working on this in Russia. One of them is GRU, which is the military intelligence. The other are these so-called private trolls that are sponsored by Putin and the Kremlin through his entourage, particularly a man called Yevgeny Prigozhin. The most well-known of these operations is in St. Petersburg. It's called the Internet Research Agency, or IRA for short, which is a wonderful acronym, if you know what the Irish Republican Army stood for. And the trolls flooded Western, not just American, but Western media with all kinds of divisive, polarizing bots, Facebook pages, disinformation, lies, media of all sorts, and flooded them, literally, because you can do this very cheaply. And exploited every single division you can find, both in American society and in Western society. So they had bots that would be anti-African American, or bots that saying that, for example, that the African Americans shouldn't vote because neither candidate is going to do anything for them.
Again, working on the divisions and rifts in our polity. Steve, we have to take a short break. We'll be right back with more on basically what's been going on in our elections and what the Russians are now doing. It seems to attack our energy sector and therefore our political prospects as well, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting with one of the country's preeminent authorities on Russia. His name is Dr. Stephen Blank. He has studied it closely. He has taught countless students, including many in our senior military ranks, about Russia, and before that, the Soviet Union. He is the author of and editor of some 15 books on this and related subjects, and a great resource for us here at Secure Freedom Radio. We're always glad to have him with us, and he's spending a full hour with us, for which we are particularly grateful. Dr. Blank, we were in the midst of a conversation about what the Russians have done to date in terms of trying to foster and exacerbate rifts within our political life, or party politic, if you will. Finish that thought, if you would, in terms specifically of what you think they're up to at the moment in the 2020 cycle.
Okay, well, as of today, what we know is for this year is that they have tried to intervene on behalf of or make propaganda for Senator Sanders, in the belief that a Sanders-Trump election would be the most polarizing election in America, and therefore weaken America from their point of view. Second, they are also supporting President Trump because they regard him as the candidate who is most likely to be more favorable to their interests. And again, as I pointed out in the earlier segment, when you look at this, it's not just enough to read what they're doing. You have to try to understand this from their point of view, not ours. And from their point of view, these calculations are what governs. And the tactic, of course, and this is true for all of Western societies, not just us, but Sweden, Great Britain, so on, is you find what the divisions are in that society, and you aggravate them, you exploit them. So if racial tension is a problem in this country, you play on that. You play on interreligious or interethnic tensions in other countries and so on.
Yeah. No, I get that, Steve. But I think it would also be fair to say that if you could put into the political fray in this country the idea that the Russians actually favor Donald Trump, that would be good in terms of dividing us and undermining this president as well. So I see a number of different angles to this, and I know you do as well. It's just that when, as you cited earlier, you look at some of the things that Hillary Clinton, you know, may have done rhetorically, but you contrast it with what she actually did for the Russians, it does seem to me as though it's a bit skewed to think that either she or Joe Biden, for that matter, would be a tougher problem for the Kremlin than Donald Trump is. But I think the bigger point is this. They want to muck about in our elections, for sure, and to foster a weaker America. And to that end, let me just pivot, if I may, to what is a very hostile act, it would seem, maybe quite understandable from their perspective, but still very hostile to us, I would argue, to Donald Trump's presidency and re-election prospects, but more to the point, to our energy sector. Talk, if you would, Steve Blank, about what the Russians are doing with the Saudis, or against the Saudis, as the case may be, but very decidedly to the detriment of the fracking industry in the United States.
Okay. This is a long explanation. So, the Russians and the Saudis since 2016 had been cooperating with an OPEC, with the Saudis led OPEC, to keep oil prices at a reasonably high level, so they and to suppress production in order to maximize their revenue output. The problem for the Russians is that by doing that, they allowed unintentionally for American producers who are extremely efficient to also make a fortune and to gain market share in energy at their expense. Now, along comes the coronavirus, which depresses demand already in China and else, and now is going to depress demand globally on a massive scale. So in the early stages of this, they see that there's an opportunity here for them to break with OPEC and have a price war, a market share war. That's what this is all about. They are going to flood the market with oil because since energy is the mainstay of the Russian economy, they have nothing else going for them but oil and gas. So they've got to produce as much as possible. And they believe that they can produce as much as possible and force the Saudis to accept their power in the energy business at the same time as knocking out American shale producers who will go to the wall at low prices, or so it's believed. And therefore, they will be able to take the hit and come out on top. Now, and I'm summarizing what's a rather more complicated picture. The problem here is I think they made the wrong bet. Now, the Saudis may or may not be able to produce as much as possible, just like the Russians, for as long as possible, and depress energy prices. And you could just see that when you go to your gas station or you get your next heating bill. But it's not clear to me that although American energy producers are going to be destroyed. Now, many companies are going to be hit. We already have seen already in the last 6 months or so many of the smaller shale producing entities being in real trouble because they were financed by debt and the price has gone down and they're going to have trouble meeting their debts. But I think that the American energy sector is so much more efficient than what the Russians are. And now that global demand is going to be so depressed for an indefinite length of time due to the coronavirus, and that's obvious to everybody, that I think it's not going to work out for the Russians. And I think they actually shot themselves in the foot. I could be wrong. This is going to play out over several months.
Well, it's decidedly having an effect on the energy sector here as we speak. So we're getting some early returns, but you're right. We'll see. It will depend, I guess, on how long this goes on and what steps that, you know, might mitigate some of the effects we'll have.
I mean, the Trump administration, right before the coronavirus exploded on them, announced that they're going to give support to the energy industry, and I think they certainly will. I don't think Trump will allow there to be a collapse of the energy industry on his watch. And frankly, I don't think a Democratic president would either.
Well, the guys who want to put the fossil fuel industry out of business, I guess, might fall into that category, but certainly, the guy who wants to put it out of business most earnestly is in this country is Vladimir Putin. And we've seen him, as you know, Steve, not only engaging in this price war business, but over the years trying to foster environmental opposition to fracking and, you know, the pipelines and so on as well. So this is a longstanding play by Vladimir Putin, and understandable. It's just not a friendly thing, needless to say.
No, that's not friendly at all, and it's what they've been doing in Europe as well. But the ultimate objective is not only to drive American energy producers to the wall, it's also to force the United States to cut the sanctions.
Presumably both. Steve Blank, let me ask you, you mentioned the coronavirus. There has been a remarkable absence of information about Russia finding itself afflicted by this disease. I find that extraordinary in light of the seeming correlation between the presence of Chinese nationals in various places, whether it's, you know, Italy or whether it's some of the Asian countries, of course, Iran, that there does seem to be some relationship, if not direct, at least some relationship between their presence and the virus. And yet there are large numbers of Chinese, of course, in primarily the eastern part of Russia, Siberia. Do you have any read on what's actually happening with respect to the coronavirus? Is it just a case that the Russians are not reporting it or that somehow they've actually been spared it?
No, they've not been spared. There are three things going on here. First of all, when the first cases came out of China, they started closing the border in the Far East. Second, there are not as many Chinese in the Far East as people like to assume. Third, this week, the last week or so, they have moved into high gear because they are getting the same pattern we had, where you start out with a few cases and it doubles every couple of days and just explodes. They are already in crisis. You're not going to read about the full extent of the crisis. The Russian healthcare system is a disaster in many ways. I'll give you one example. There's a paper from CSIS by a scholar named Judith Twigg. One in three hospitals, I think, in the country doesn't have running water. Just imagine something like that. They are going to try to conceal the extent, just as China did and just as Iran has. Iran and China are the two most heavily affected countries. Italy, of course, very severely, but not quite as much, although that could change. Russia is going to be in that league, I believe. They're already getting the cases. They've already started closing the border and so forth. But to give you an example, they've run out of hospital beds in St. Petersburg already. You're going to get bits and pieces of the news, but you're not going to easily get a full picture of what is happening across the entire length of the country.
But it's not the case, based on your research and information, that they've been spared this by any means. This is still a building. Steve, just a point of, you know, clarity. When you say there aren't as many Chinese in Siberia as many of us think, what is your understanding of their presence there? I thought that this has been building for quite some time, that they've essentially begun to effectively, if not de jure, expropriate territory in the Far East of Russia.
This is a myth. It's a myth, and your listeners should understand that the Chinese are not migrating en masse to Siberia. I mean, they have substantial economic interests, and in some cases they're buying land, but there is no Chinese takeover or invasion of Siberia taking place. You have to ask yourself, why would anybody want to go to Siberia in the Russian Far East?
Well, it's not a garden spot, that's for sure, but there's a lot of wealth up there, as you know. And for Lebensraum purposes, the theory has been that they want to take over as much of that land as they can. Steve, hold the thought. We'll be right back with much more with Dr. Stephen Blank right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with one of my favorite colleagues, a man who has deeply studied these issues of, well, what I call the war for the free world, specifically taking a hard look at what Russia under Vladimir Putin is up to and its implications, not just for this country, but truly for freedom around the world. Steve Blank, we were talking animatedly about what's going on in Russia at the moment, the Far East, China, and so on. And you were making the point that why would anybody really want to be in the Far East? And the theory that I've been operating under is that the Chinese go to all kinds of places that one might not want to be, but they find it strategically useful, whether it's some particularly difficult places in Africa or elsewhere in Central Asia, Afghanistan, for example. But the Far East of Russia is rich with things that the Chinese want, is it not? Whether it's lumber, whether it's gold, whether it's oil and gas. And I just been under the understanding that they've been, as is their want, you know, using the vast numbers of people they have to sort of colonize those kinds of strategic areas of the world, including Russia.
This is one of those myths that's urban legends, if you like, that circulate through the profession. But it's not true. They're buying all this stuff. I mean, if you talk to people in the lumber business, or you look at the lumber, they're buying timber and lumber, and they've had an enormous demand for it, and presumably they will in the future. But they're not settling in Siberia in these kinds of numbers. There are day traders, if you like, coming in and out, but they're not settling there. They're buying it. It's a different story.
Yeah. No, it is a different story. It seems at odds with the general practice, though. I mean, when you look at this Belt and Road Initiative business, for example, many of the countries in question thought that they would just come in and buy stuff, or they would, you know, hire local people to build the things that they're offering, and ports and airfields and railroad networks and roads and so on, only to discover that they bring along with them the entire workforce from China. So it does seem a bit odd that that's not being done in Siberia, but I will defer to you on it.
If you look at the BRI, the Belt and Road Initiative, it's true that, let's say, in Central Asia, the Chinese employ their own people and bring them in. But there are precious few BRI programs in Siberia and Far East. The Russians are not really in it to any great extent. Most of the Russo-Chinese economic relationship, which is vital to the Russians, is a bilateral relationship, and it's in practice not really connected to the BRI. Rhetorically, they say it is, and that the Chinese and they are building a greater Eurasian setup. But the fact is, the Chinese, and this is very typically Chinese, are just building their own program, and the Russians have to scramble after them. So there's no real colonization of Siberia and the Russian Far East, and that's just a myth.
Well, I stand corrected, and I appreciate very much your insights into it. Steve, I want to come back to something you said a moment ago that was stunning to me, that a third of the hospitals in Russia don't have running water. It's awfully hard to imagine. I mean, you have to go back to, you know, sort of the pre-industrial age. Hospitals being able to do their job of tending to those who are ill in an effective way, to say nothing of a cost-effective way, without running water. This is in stark contrast, of course, to the immense investment that Vladimir Putin has been making in his country's strategic and other nuclear forces. We've talked about it from time to time over the past year or two. What's up with this? Is this simply that he doesn't give a fig about the people of Russia, but he's all about the superpower status of the Russian Federation, or is there something else going on that is not self-evident?
Well, this is a traditional phenomenon. We saw a similar situation under the Soviets, as you remember. The superpower status is an obsession, and I don't use that word lightly. And military spending is very high, but even though they are under constraints, and it's exactly under the defense budget has been trimmed and is going to continue to be put under a ceiling for some time, because he's now trying to spend more money. At least they announced they were going to, the new government that came in January, is going to spend more money on, you know, social welfare and infrastructure and so on. But there are enormous issues here. The problem, first of all, massive corruption and inefficiency in the economy, which means that these things don't get built in time, they don't get built well enough, and there's little or no concern for environmental support, if you like. Let me give you an example beside the hospitals. One of the showcase projects that Putin is investing an enormous amount of money in is the Arctic, because they think that the climate change is going to allow them to use the Arctic year-round for navigation and so on. But what they did not figure is that because all the buildings in the Arctic are built on permafrost, that all that permafrost is going to melt unless climate change is arrested, and all those buildings are going to fall into the ground because their foundation will melt. And I mean, there's going to be, and they have methane gas craters all over the Arctic, and they've got pipelines and energy facilities and nuclear reactors in the Arctic and so on. And God forbid you have another accident like you had in last summer with a weapons testing nuclear weapon, which misfired, and a bunch of people were killed and others exposed to radiation. You could have massive disasters there. And now they've got coronavirus.
Chilling thought. Steve, speaking again of coronavirus, one of the things that we've been getting reports about is that Russia has been very intensively seeking to use its disinformation capabilities, which are awesome, for the purposes of sowing panic in the West, as Reuters put it in a headline piece recently. What's the purpose of that, as you see it, especially if they're going to have problems of their own? Is this simply designed to obscure what's going on in Russia itself, or otherwise gain strategic advantage in the West?
Well, it's all three. It's to sow panic, discredit Western governments, deflect attention from what's going on inside Russia, and secure some sort of lasting strategic advantage. It's all three. That's for them. This is what information warfare is all about. And in many cases, you read the military literature, information warfare to them is the most important form of warfare today. And this is a prime example of it.
Yeah. And again, one of the things that I value so much about your corporate memory on all of these things, Dr. Blank, is that you appreciate the extent to which the Russians, going back to Soviet times, really have invested in these kinds of capabilities and continue to exploit them to their advantage and to our detriment. And it's another indicator of the abiding hostility of this regime to us. Let me ask you about one other piece of the puzzle. There's Russian activities in lots of different places around the world that I'm interested in sort of updating with you on. Steve, how about Turkey? What exactly is the state of Turkish relations at the moment? There's obviously considerable friction between them in Syria, but more generally, how would you characterize that relationship?
I think there is a lot of friction generally in those relations. Syria is one case. This Turkish government's buying of Russia's S-400 air defense system is another major irritant. Turkey and Europe are very much at odds now over the issues pertaining to migrants, because Turkey is trying to blackmail Europe into taking millions of people. But I mean, the burden on Turkey is considerable. They've taken a lot of refugees from Syria, and there will be more because the Syrian nightmare is not ending anytime soon.
But those are two examples of friction between Turkey and the West. But the S-400 deal presumably is evidence of a cordial relationship, an entente or something, I guess you might say, between Russia and the Turks, no?
I would not describe it as an entente. We saw that the Turks and the Russians almost came to blows just a couple of weeks ago in Syria, in a very serious crisis. I think it's a true marriage of convenience right now. Putin's overriding aim, of course, is to split NATO and to secure for Russia a lasting, strong strategic position, if not sort of security manager for the Middle East, particularly in Syria, at least as a starting point. Turkey's objectives are under Erdogan, Turkey wants to play some sort of, I guess people call it neo-Ottoman kind of role. And certainly he's determined not to let the Kurds, who are in Syria as well as in Turkey, form any kind of independent political association. And he wants to have an influence over what happens in Syria too.
We're going to take another short final break with Dr. Stephen Blank of the American Foreign Policy Council, and for many years a prominent fixture at the U.S. Army War College. We'll pick up on the question of what the Turks pose to Russia as a possible Islamist problem, among other things, on the other side of a very short break right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of this very special conversation with Dr. Stephen Blank, one of our country's preeminent experts on Russia and what it is up to under Vladimir Putin. And Steve, we were talking before the break about what the attitude is on the part of Vladimir Putin towards Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey and his government. You mentioned that there is clearly an aspiration on the part of Erdogan to reconstitute the caliphate. Russia is very concerned, as I understand it, and I think properly so, about this, I think of it as sort of Sharia supremacism that is already present in some parts of the Russian Federation and has been a problem in the past and almost certainly will be in the future, especially as the demographics of the Muslim populations increase. What does Russia make of the role that Erdogan is playing in that regard. Is it a threat?
Okay, first of all, Erdogan's ambitions are not religious, they are political. There's no attempt to restore the caliphate by Erdogan. I mean, this is the kind of thing ISIS talks about, not Erdogan. So that has to be understood. So that's a mistaken belief.
I beg to disagree. I think that's well documented, and I'd be happy to have further discussion with you about that. But it's tied to the political. There's no question about it. It's a political ambition, but it has that theocratic wellspring.
The Russians do not fear Turkey's religious orientation. What they are concerned about with Turkey is its political and strategic orientation. The religious aspect of this is are jihadi groups, and Turkey is not a jihadi state. I mean, and people who say that get are just wrong. I mean, Erdogan uses Islam for political purposes, but it would be a mistake to call it a jihadi state.
It is a regime that is tied to jihad through its commitment to Sharia, Steve, and it is clearly the case that it has supported ISIS on its territory and in neighboring regions. It is tied to the Muslim Brotherhood throughout the world, including in our own country. I think that's an error, but it may not be the way the Russians see it, but it's the way it is objectively, I'm afraid.
Yes, that does not drive the Russian calculus. You're right about that, but Turkey's support of these guys is instrumental, and it's not what's driving the Russian calculus about Turkey and the Middle East. The Russians are well informed about these groups. They've been studying them for centuries. They have a very robust academic and political tradition studying Islamic communities, so they know their stuff. The issue with Russian Turkey is a strategic one. Now, the Turks, for example, are challenging the Russians in Libya. They're supporting the government. Russia's supporting the insurgent.
And Turkey has now deployed troops to Libya, as I recall, to sort of prop up their government.
And both Russia and Turkey in Syria have recruited jihadist militias to their side. I mean, this does not get a lot of press, but this is what's at stake. Well, what is at the root of the crisis we saw last month? If your listeners remember that, both of these governments have recruited various militias to their side in Syria in support of their objectives. And then they are all maneuvering and sometimes with force against each other or with each other for various objectives, which we just don't have time to get into.
But in short, it's, I guess, safe to say the Russians are perfectly prepared to work with some of these jihadist groups as long as they're not posing a threat to the government itself in Russia, and whether that's, you know, but aligning on occasion with the Turks or, you know, confronting them. It's all a matter of sort of circumstance.
To give you an example, in 2016, Erdogan, and correctly, stated that Russia was behind the episodes of Kurdish terrorism in Turkey. The Russian government has been using the Kurds as an instrument against the Turkish government since 1890, back to the Tsars. Yeah, so this is just another chapter.
That's a source of long-running friction. Steve, I wanted to ask you a question that some have said is of no particular consequence because it's simply codifying what has been happening in Russia for the past 10 years or so. Namely, that Putin went to the trouble of essentially formalizing through constitutional changes in the Duma his hold on power for presumably the rest of his life. Did this materially change anything or come as a surprise to you, or is it otherwise of note?
I don't think it's changed anything so far, at least in real life. Maybe it's changed, you know, what's going to be written on paper in terms of a, quote, new constitution, end quote. It's no surprise to, I think, anybody in our profession that he's been searching for ways to guarantee and perpetuate his power. We all take that for granted. But, you know, this process is not yet over. And I confess to being mystified by a lot of what's been going on here. I don't understand why he went through all these processes to do this. I mean, I've seen various interpretations, and some make more sense than others, but I'm not convinced by any of them. And I don't fully understand why he's done this and why he's what's going to happen at the end that is materially different than what we saw at the beginning.
I think you've written about the fact that he seems to be tracking with his Chinese, well, I guess allies, one would call them, in terms of establishing his sort of comparable status to that of Xi Jinping. Does that have some bearing on it?
Yes, it does. I think certainly he's doing what the Chinese have, what Xi Jinping has done, and they're copying some Chinese domestic practices, which is another sign, I think, of you, what I believe and what you believe is an alliance. But at the end of the day, there was no challenge to Putin in December, January, and there's not going to be a challenge to him whenever this process ends. So I'm not completely clear why he did this and what he expected to gain that he didn't already have.
Well, presumably it's muscle flexing. I always default to that, I guess, when it comes to Vladimir Putin. Let me ask you quickly, and lastly, if I may, Steve Blank, we talked a little bit about the massive investment that Putin has been making in nuclear forces, the buildup that has flowed from it, I think unprecedented in its size. And as we've discussed in the past, the fact that he is routinely doing these strategic exercises with his finger on the simulated button, launching thermonuclear attacks against this country. It's a very ominous thing. At the same time, as you've pointed out, there's a new charm offensive underway with respect to arms control. What do you make of that? What should we make of that?
The Russians want arms control now for a number of reasons. One, they want to stop the renovation of the American nuclear forces in its infancy. Second, they would like to cap the competition so that the burden, the economic burden, doesn't get any higher. Third, they are desperate for the United States to recognize Russia, as, and we talked about this earlier, as equal, and nuclear arms control negotiations have always served that purpose. This is part of this endless obsession about status, which is pervades all of Russian foreign policy. Now, they have made all kinds of offers to the United States to negotiate, but there are real problems here. The U.S. government, and I think the administration's right about this, insists that China needs to be in the room. The Russians used to agree with that. That was the position 10 years ago. As part of the alliance with China, that's gone by the wayside, and the Chinese refused to, up till now, to talk about taking part in arms control. Second, the Russians broke the INF treaty. They've broken the CFE treaty too, conventional arms in Europe. And they are attempting to get a treaty that will constrain us from doing anything about it. Now, they are really worried, I think, about our missile defenses, even though I'm not sure that our missile defenses could ever stop the Russian nuclear arsenal. They are concerned about our strike capabilities. And they are very concerned that we're going to build some sort of retaliation to what they did with the INF, which would be a direct threat. Now, you remember from your time in the Reagan administration, when they were building these missiles to threaten Europe, we built the Pershings and the ground-launched cruise missiles, the GLTMs, that could hit Moscow from Europe in 10 minutes. And that's what led to the INF treaty. They're worried about us doing something against them now. They broke the treaty. They want it, and they want to say, okay, we're not going to build anymore. You know, you can trust us, but you can't build anything either.
But in both cases, I guess the common denominator, Steve Blank, is that they would like to lock in the advantages that they have been busily putting into place, and we have yet to respond to. Steve, we are hard out of time. I have to just say thank you for your time today, as well as your extraordinary expertise and that you've provided so many generations of us in the course of your distinguished career at the Army War College, as well as, of course, the work that you're doing these days as a senior fellow for Russia at the American Foreign Policy Council. I hope you come back to us again very soon, Steve, and I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.